was beginning to think of Frank as well as Ashley. So this was the explanation of his apparent calm this evening. He had promised her he would have nothing to do with the clan. Oh, this was just the kind of trouble she had feared would come upon them. All the work of this last year would go for nothing. All her struggles and fears and labor in rain and cold had been wasted. And who would have thought that spiritless old Frank would get himself mixed up in the hot-headed doings of the clan? Even at this minute he might be dead. And if he wasn't dead and the Yankees caught him, he'd be hanged. And Ashley, too. Her nails dug into her palms until four bright red crescents showed. How could Melanie read on and on so calmly when Ashley was in danger of being hanged, when he might be dead? But something in the cool, soft voice reading the sorrows of Jean Valjean steadied her, kept her from leaping to her feet and screaming. Her mind fled back to the night Tony Fontaine had come to them, hunted, exhausted, without money. If he hadn't reached their house and received money and a fresh horse, he would have been hanged long since. If Frank and Ashley weren't dead at this very minute, they were in Tony's position, only worse. With a house surrounded by soldiers, they couldn't come home and get money and clothes without being captured. And probably every house up and down the street had a similar guard of Yankees, so they couldn't apply to friends for aid. Even now they might be riding wildly through the night, bound for Texas. But Rhett. Perhaps Rhett had reached them in time. Rhett always had plenty of cash in his pocket. Perhaps he would lend them enough to see them through. But that was queer. Why should Rhett bother himself about Ashley's safety? Certainly he disliked him. Certainly he professed a contempt for him. Then why? But this riddle was swallowed up in a renewed fear for the safety of Ashley and Frank. "Oh, it's all my fault," she wailed to herself. "India and Archie spoke the truth. It's all my fault. But I never thought either of them was foolish enough to join the clan. And I never thought anything would really happen to me. But I couldn't have done otherwise. Melly spoke the truth. People have to do what they have to do. And I had to keep the mills going. I had to have money. And now I'll probably lose it all, and somehow it's all my fault." After a long time, Melanie's voice faltered, trailed off, and was silent. She turned her head toward the window and stared as though no Yankee soldier stared back from behind the glass. The others raised their heads, caught by her listening pose. And they too listened. There was a sound of horses' feet and of singing, deadened by the closed windows and doors, borne away by the wind but still recognizable. It was the most hated and hateful of songs. The song about Sherman's men marching through Georgia. And Rhett Butler was singing it. Hardly had he finished the first lines when two other voices, drunken voices, assailed him. Enraged, foolish voices that stumbled over words and blurred them together. There was a quick command from Captain Jaffrey on the front porch, and the rapid tramp of feet. But even before these sounds arose, the ladies looked at one another, stunned, for the drunken voices expostulating with Rhett were those of Ashley and Hugh Elsing. Voices rose louder on the front walk, Captain Jaffrey's curt and questioning, Hugh shrill with foolish laughter, Rhett's deep and reckless, and Ashley's queer, unreal shouting.
"What the hell? What the hell?"
"That can't be Ashley," thought Scarlet wildly. "He never gets drunk. And Rhett, why, when Rhett's drunk, he gets quieter and quieter. Never loud like that." Melanie rose, and with her, Archie rose. They heard the captain's sharp voice.
"These two men are under arrest."
And Archie's hand closed over his pistol butt. "No," whispered Melanie firmly. "No, leave it to me." There was, in her face, the same look Scarlet had seen that day at Tara, when Melanie had stood at the top of the steps looking down at the dead Yankee, her weak wrist weighed down by the heavy saber, a gentle and timid soul nerved by circumstances to the caution and fury of a tigress. She threw the front door open. "Bring him in, Captain Butler," she called in a clear tone that bit with venom. "I suppose you've gotten him intoxicated again. Bring him in." From the dark, windy walk, the Yankee captain spoke. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Wilkes, but your husband and Mr. Elsing are under arrest."
"Arrest? For what? For drunkenness?"
"If everyone in Atlanta was arrested for drunkenness, the whole Yankee garrison would be in jail continually." "Well, bring him in, Captain Butler. That is, if you can walk yourself." Scarlett's mind wasn't working quickly, and for a brief moment nothing made sense. She knew neither Rhett nor Ashley was drunk, and she knew Melanie knew they weren't drunk. Yet here was Melanie, usually so gentle and refined, screaming like a shrew, and in front of Yankees, too, that both of them were too drunk to walk. There was a short, mumbled argument, punctuated with curses, and uncertain feet ascended the stairs. In the doorway appeared Ashley, white-faced, his head lolling, his bright hair tousled, his long body wrapped from neck to knees in Rhett's black cape. Hugh Elsing and Rhett, none too steady on their feet, supported him on either side, and it was obvious he would have fallen to the floor but for their aid. Behind them came the Yankee captain, his face a study of mingled suspicion and amusement. He stood in the open doorway with his men peering curiously over his shoulders, and the cold wind swept the house. Scarlett, frightened, puzzled, glanced at Melanie and back to the sagging Ashley, and then half-comprehension came to her. She started to cry out, "But he can't be drunk," and bit back the words. She realized she was witnessing a play, a desperate play on which lives hinged. She knew she wasn't part of it, nor was Aunt Pity, but the others were, and they were tossing cues to one another like actors in an oft-rehearsed drama. She understood only half, but she understood enough to keep silent. "Put him in the chair," cried Melanie indignantly. "And you, Captain Butler, leave this house immediately. How dare you show your face here after getting him in this condition again?" The two men eased Ashley into a rocker, and Rhett, swaying, caught hold of the back of the chair to steady himself and addressed the captain with pain in his voice. "That's fine thanks, Agit, isn't it? For keeping the police from getting him and bringing him home and him yelling and trying to claw me."
"And you, Hugh Elsing, I'm ashamed of you. What will your poor mother say, drunk and out with a Yankee-loving scalawag like Captain Butler? And, oh, Mr. Wilkes, how could you do such a thing?"
"Millie, I ain't so very drunk," mumbled Ashley. And with the words fell forward and lay face down on the table, his head buried in his arms.
"Archie, take him to his room and put him to bed."
"As usual,"
ordered Melanie. "Aunt Pity, please run and fix the bed, and oh, she suddenly burst into tears. "Oh, how could he, after he promised?" Archie already had his arm under Ashley's shoulder, and Pity, frightened and uncertain, was on her feet when the captain interposed.
"Don't touch him. He's under arrest. Sergeant!"
As the sergeant stepped into the room, his rifle at trail, Rhett, evidently trying to steady himself, put a hand on the captain's arm and, with difficulty, focused his eyes.
"Tom, what are you arresting him for? He ain't so very drunk. I've seen him drunker."
"Drunk be damned," cried the captain. "He can lie in the gutter for all I care. I'm no policeman. He and Mr. Elsing are under arrest for complicity in a Klan raid at Shantytown tonight. A nigger and a white man were killed. Mr. Wilkes was the ringleader in it."
"Tonight?"
Rhett began to laugh. He laughed so hard that he sat down on the sofa and put his head in his hands.
"Not tonight, Tom," he said when he could speak. "These two have been with me tonight, ever since 8 o'clock, when they were supposed to be at the meeting."
"With you, Rhett, but—" A frown came over the captain's forehead, and he looked uncertainly at the snoring Ashley and his weeping wife.
"But where were you?"
"I don't like to say. And Rhett shot a look of drunken cunning at Melanie. You'd better say.
Let's go out on the porch and I'll tell you where we were.
You'll tell me now.
Hate to say it in front of the ladies. If you ladies will step out of the room.
I won't go, cried Melanie, dabbing angrily at her eyes with her handkerchief. I have a right to know. Where was my husband?
At Belle Watling's sporting house, said Rhett, looking abashed. He was there, and Hugh, and Frank Kennedy, and Dr. Meade, and a whole lot of them. Had a party, big party, champagne, girls.
At Belle Watling's? Melanie's voice rose until it cracked with such pain that all eyes turned frightenedly to her. Her hand went clutching at her bosom, and before Archie could catch her, she had fainted. Then a hubbub ensued, Archie picking her up, India running to the kitchen for water, Pity and Scarlet fanning her and slapping her wrists, while Hugh Elsing shouted over and over, "Now you've done it! Now you've done it!"
"Now it'll be all over town," said Rhett savagely. "I hope you're satisfied, Tom. There won't be a wife in Atlanta who'll speak to a husband tomorrow."
"Rhett, I had no idea."
Though the chill wind was blowing through the open door on his back, the captain was perspiring.
"Look here. You take oath they were at Bell's?"
"Hell yes," growled Rhett. "Go ask Belle herself if you don't believe me. Now let me carry Mrs. Wilkes to her room. Give her to me, Archie." "Yes, I can carry her." "Miss Pity, go ahead with the lamp."
He took Melanie's limp body from Archie's arms with ease.
"You get Mr. Wilkes to bed, Archie. I don't want to ever lay eyes or hands on him again after this night."
Pity's hand trembled so that the lamp was a menace to the safety of the house. But she held it and trotted ahead toward the dark bedroom. Archie, with a grunt, got an arm under Ashley and raised him.
"But I've got to arrest these men."
Rhett turned in the dim hallway.
"Arrest them in the morning, then. They can't run away in this condition. And I never knew before that it was illegal to get drunk in a sporting house. Good God, Tom, there are 50 witnesses to prove they were at Bell's."
"There are always 50 witnesses to prove a Southerner was somewhere where he wasn't," said the captain morosely.
"You come with me, Mr. Elsing. I'll parole Mr. Wilkes on the word of—"
"I am Mr. Wilkes's sister. I will answer for his appearance," said India coldly. "Now will you please go? You've caused enough trouble for one night."
"I regret it exceedingly."
The captain bowed awkwardly.
"I only hope they can prove their presence at the, Mrs. Watling's house. Will you tell your brother that he must appear before the provost marshal tomorrow morning for questioning?"
India bowed coldly and, putting her hand upon the doorknob, intimated silently that his speedy retirement would be welcome. The captain and the sergeant backed out, Hugh Elsing with them, and she slammed the door behind them. Without even looking at Scarlet, she went swiftly to each window and drew down the shade. Scarlet, her knees shaking, caught hold of the chair in which Ashley had been sitting to steady herself. Looking down at it, she saw that there was a dark, moist spot, larger than her hand, on the cushion in the back of the chair. Puzzled, her hand went over it, and, to her horror, a sticky red wetness appeared on her palm. "India," she whispered. "India, Ashley's, he's hurt." "You fool. Did you think it was really drunk?" India snapped down the last shade and started on flying feet for the bedroom, with Scarlet close behind her, her heart in her throat. Rhett's big body barred the doorway, but past his shoulder, Scarlet saw Ashley lying white and still on the bed. Melanie, strangely quick for one so recently in a faint, was rapidly cutting off his blood-soaked shirt with embroidery scissors. Archie held the lamp low over the bed to give light, and one of his gnarled fingers was on Ashley's wrist.
"Is he dead?" cried both girls together.
"No. Just fainted from loss of blood. It's through his shoulder," said Rhett.
"Why did you bring him here, you fool?" cried India. "Let me go to him. Let me pass. Why did you bring him here to be arrested?"
"He was too weak to travel. There was nowhere else to bring him, Miss Wilkes. Besides, do you want him to be in exile like Tony Fontaine? Do you want a dozen of your neighbors to live in Texas under assumed names for the rest of their lives? There's a chance that we may get them all off if Belle—"
"Let me pass."
"No, Miss Wilkes. There's work for you. You must go for a doctor, not Dr. Meade. He's implicated in this and is probably explaining to the Yankees at this very minute. Get some other doctor. Are you afraid to go out alone at night?"
"No," said India, her pale eyes glittering. "I'm not afraid." She caught up Melanie's hooded cape, which was hanging on a hook in the hall. "I'll go for old Dr. Dean." The excitement went out of her voice as, with an effort, she forced calmness. "I'm sorry I called you a spy and a fool. I did not understand. I'm deeply grateful for what you've done for Ashley. But I despise you just the same."
"I appreciate frankness, and I thank you for it." Rhett bowed, and his lip curled down in an amused smile. "Now go quickly, and by back ways, and when you return, do not come in this house if you see signs of soldiers about."
India shot one more quick, anguished look at Ashley, and wrapping her cape about her, ran lightly down the hall to the back door and let herself out quietly into the night. Scarlet, straining her eyes past Rhett, felt her heart beat again as she saw Ashley's eyes open. Melanie snatched a folded towel from the washstand rack and pressed it against his streaming shoulder, and he smiled up weakly, reassuringly, into her face. Scarlet felt Rhett's hard, penetrating eyes upon her, knew that her heart was plain upon her face. But she didn't care. Ashley was bleeding, perhaps dying, and she who loved him had torn that hole through his shoulder. She wanted to run to the bed, sink down beside it, and clasp him to her, but her knees trembled so that she couldn't enter the room. Hand at her mouth, she stared while Melanie packed a fresh towel against his shoulder, pressing it hard as though she could force back the blood into his body. But the towel reddened as though by magic. How could a man bleed so much and still live? But thank God there was no bubble of blood at his lips. Oh, those frothy red bubbles, forerunners of death that she knew so well from the dreadful day of the battle at Peachtree Creek when the wounded had died on Aunt Pity's lawn with bloody mouths. "Brace up," said Rhett. And there was a hard, faintly jeering note in his voice. "He won't die. Now go take the lamp and hold it for Mrs. Wilkes. I need Archie to run errands." Archie looked across the lamp at Rhett. "I ain't taking no orders from you," he said briefly, shifting his wad of tobacco to the other cheek.
"You do what he says," said Melanie sternly, "and do it quickly. Do everything Captain Butler says. Scarlet, take the lamp."
Scarlet went forward and took the lamp, holding it in both hands to keep from dropping it. Ashley's eyes had closed again. His bare chest heaved up slowly and sank quickly, and the red stream seeped from between Melanie's small, frantic fingers. Dimly she heard Archie stump across the room to Rhett and heard Rhett's low, rapid words. Her mind was so fixed upon Ashley that, of the first half-whispered words of Rhett, she only heard, "Take my horse. Tied outside. Ride like hell." Archie mumbled some question, and Scarlet heard Rhett reply, "The old Sullivan plantation. You'll find the robes pushed up the biggest chimney. Burn them." Grunted Archie. "And there's two men in the cellar. Pack them over the horse as best you can, and take them to that vacant lot behind Bell's, the one between her house and the railroad tracks. Be careful. If anyone sees you, you'll hang as well as the rest of us. Put them in that lot and put pistols near them. In the hands.
Here, take mine.
Scarlet, looking across the room, saw Rhett reach under his coattails and produce two revolvers which Archie took and shoved into his waistband.
Fire one shot from each. It's got to appear like a plain case of shooting. You understand?
Archie nodded as if he understood perfectly, and an unwilling gleam of respect shone in his cold eye. But understanding was far from Scarlet. The last half hour had been so nightmarish that she felt nothing would ever be plain and clear again. However, Rhett seemed in perfect command of the bewildering situation, and that was a small comfort. Archie turned to go and then swung about, and his one eye went questioningly to Rhett's face.
Him? Yes.
Archie grunted and spat on the floor.
Hell to pay, he said, as he stumped down the hall to the back door.
Something in the last low interchange of words made a new fear and suspicion rise up in Scarlet's breast like a chill, ever-swelling bubble. When that bubble broke...
Where's Frank? She cried.
Rhett came swiftly across the room to the bed, his big body swinging as lightly and noiselessly as a cat's.
All in good time, he said, and smiled briefly. Steady that lamp, Scarlet. You don't want to burn Mr. Wilkes up.
Miss Melly.
Melanie looked up like a good little soldier awaiting a command, and so tense was the situation, it didn't occur to her that for the first time, Rhett was calling her familiarly by the name which only family and old friends used.
I beg your pardon. I mean, Mrs. Wilkes.
Oh, Captain Butler, do not ask my pardon. I should feel honored if you called me Melly without the miss. I feel as though you were my brother, or my cousin. How kind you are, and how clever. How can I ever thank you enough?
Thank you, said Rhett, and for a moment he looked almost embarrassed.
I should never presume so far, but Miss Melly, and his voice was apologetic. I'm sorry I had to say that Mr. Wilkes was in Belle Watling's house. I'm sorry to have involved him and the others in such a... But I had to think fast when I rode away from here, and that was the only plan that occurred to me. I knew my word would be accepted because I have so many friends among the Yankee officers. They do me the dubious honor of thinking me almost one of them, because they know my, shall we call it, my unpopularity among my townsmen. And you see, I was playing poker in Bell's bar earlier in the evening. There are a dozen Yankee soldiers who can testify to that. And Belle and her girls would gladly lie themselves black in the face and say Mr. Wilkes and the others were upstairs all evening. And the Yankees will believe them. Yankees are queer that way. It won't occur to them that women of their profession are capable of intense loyalty or patriotism. The Yankees wouldn't take the word of a single nice Atlanta lady as to the whereabouts of the men who were supposed to be at the meeting tonight, but they will take the word of... fancy ladies. And I think that between the word of honor of a scalawag and a dozen fancy ladies, we may have a chance of getting the men off. There was a sardonic grin on his face at the last words, but it faded as Melanie turned up to him a face that blazed with gratitude.
Captain Butler, you are so smart.
I wouldn't have cared if you'd said they were in hell itself tonight, if it saves them.
For I know, and everyone else who matters knows, that my husband was never in a dreadful place like that.
Well, began Rhett awkwardly, as a matter of fact, he was at Bell's tonight.
Melanie drew herself up coldly.
You can never make me believe such a lie.
Please, Miss Melly, let me explain. When I got out to the old Sullivan place tonight, I found Mr. Wilkes wounded, and with him were Hugh Elsing and Dr. Meade and old man Merriweather.
Not the old gentleman, cried Scarlet.
Men are never too old to be fools. And your Uncle Henry...
Oh, mercy, cried Aunt Pity.
The others had scattered after the brush with the troops, and the crowd that stuck together had come to the Sullivan place to have their robes in the chimney and see how badly Mr. Wilkes was hurt. But for his wound, they'd be headed for Texas by now, all of them. But he couldn't ride far, and they wouldn't leave him.
It was necessary to prove that they had been somewhere instead of where they had been, and so I took them by back ways to Bill Watling's.
Oh, I see. I do beg your pardon for my rudeness, Captain Butler. I see now it was necessary to take them there, but... Oh, Captain Butler, people must have seen you going in.
No one saw us. We went in through a private back entrance that opens on the railroad tracks. It's always dark and locked.
Then how...
I have a key, said Rhett laconically, and his eyes met Melanie's evenly. As the full impact of the meaning smote her, Melanie became so embarrassed that she fumbled with the bandage until it slid off the wound entirely.
I did not mean to pry, she said in a muffled voice, her white face reddening as she hastily pressed the towel back into place.
I regret having to tell a lady such a thing.
Then it's true, thought Scarlet with an odd pang. Then he does live with that dreadful Watling creature. He does own her house.
I saw Belle and explained to her. We gave her a list of the men who were out tonight, and she and her girls will testify that they were all in her house tonight. Then to make our exit more conspicuous, she called the two desperados who keep order at her place and had us dragged downstairs, fighting, and through the barroom and thrown out into the street as brawling drunks who were disturbing the place. He grinned reminiscently. Dr. Meade did not make a very convincing drunk. It hurt his dignity to even be in such a place, but your Uncle Henry and old man Merriweather were excellent. The stage lost two great actors when they did not take up the drama. They seemed to enjoy the affair. I'm afraid your Uncle Henry has a black eye due to Mr. Merriweather's zeal for his part.
The back door swung open, and India entered, followed by old Dr. Dean, his long white hair tumbled, his worn leather bag bulging under his cape. He nodded briefly, but without words, to those present, and quickly lifted the bandage from Ashley's shoulder.
"Too high for the lung," he said. "If it hasn't splintered his collarbone, it's not so serious. Get me plenty of towels, ladies, and cotton, if you have it, and some brandy."
Rhett took the lamp from Scarlet and set it on the table as Melanie and India sped about, obeying the doctor's orders.
"You can't do anything here. Come into the parlor by the fire."
He took her arm and propelled her from the room. There was a gentleness foreign to him in both hand and voice.
"You've had a rotten day, haven't you?"
She allowed herself to be led into the front room, and though she stood on the hearth rug in front of the fire, she began to shiver. The bubble of suspicion in her breast was swelling larger now. It was more than a suspicion. It was almost a certainty, and a terrible certainty. She looked up into Rhett's immobile face, and for a moment she could not speak. Then, "Was Frank at Belle Watling's?"
"No."
Rhett's voice was blunt.
"Archie's carrying him to the vacant lot near Belle's. He's dead. Shot through the head."
Chapter 46. Few families in the north end of town slept that night for the news of the disaster to the clan, and Rhett's stratagem spread swiftly on silent feet as the shadowy form of India Wilkes slipped through backyards, whispered urgently through kitchen doors, and slipped away into the windy darkness. And in her path, she left fear and desperate hope. From without, houses looked black and silent and wrapped in sleep, but within, voices whispered vehemently into the dawn. Not only those involved in the night's raid, but every member of the clan was ready for flight, and in almost every stable along Peachtree Street, horses stood saddled in the darkness, pistols in holsters, and food in saddlebags. All that prevented a wholesale exodus was India's whispered message, "Captain Butler says not to run. The roads will be watched. He has arranged with that Watling creature." In dark rooms, men whispered, "But why should I trust that damn scalawag Butler? It may be a trap." And women's voices implored, "Don't go. If he saved Ashley and Hugh, he may save everybody. If India and Melanie trust him..." And they half trusted, and stayed because there was no other course open to them. Earlier in the night, the soldiers had knocked at a dozen doors, and those who could not or would not tell where they had been that night were marched off under arrest. René Picard and one of Mrs. Merriweather's nephews, and the Simmons boys, and Andy Bunnell were among those who spent the night in jail. They had been in the ill-starred foray, but had separated from the others after the shooting. Riding hard for home, they were arrested before they learned of Rhett's plan. Fortunately, they all replied to questions, that where they had been that night was their own business and not that of any damned Yankees. They had been locked up for further questioning in the morning. Old Man Merriweather and Uncle Henry Hamilton declared shamelessly that they had spent the evening at Belle Watling's sporting house, and when Captain Jaffrey remarked irritably that they were too old for such goings-on, they wanted to fight him. Belle Watling herself answered Captain Jaffrey's summons, and before he could make known his mission, she shouted that the house was closed for the night. A passel of quarrelsome drunks had called in the early part of the evening and had fought one another, torn the place up, broken her finest mirrors, and so alarmed the young ladies that all business had been suspended for the night. But if Captain Jaffrey wanted a drink, the bar was still open. Captain Jaffrey, acutely conscious of the grins of his men and feeling helplessly that he was fighting a mist, declared angrily that he wanted neither the young ladies nor a drink, and demanded if Belle knew the names of her destructive customers. Oh, yes, Belle knew them. They were her regulars. They came every Wednesday night and called themselves the Wednesday Democrats, though what they meant by that she neither knew nor cared. And if they didn't pay for the damage to the mirrors in the upper hall, she was going to have the law on them. She kept a respectable house and... Oh, their names? Belle unhesitatingly reeled off the names of 12 under suspicion. Captain Jaffrey smiled sourly. "These damned rebels are as efficiently organized as our Secret Service," he said. "You and your girls will have to appear before the provost marshal tomorrow." "Will the provost make them pay for my mirrors?" "To hell with your mirrors. Make Rhett Butler pay for them. He owns the place, doesn't he?" Before dawn, every ex-Confederate family in town knew everything. And their Negroes, who had been told nothing, knew everything, too, by that black grapevine telegraph system which defies white understanding. Everyone knew the details of the raid, the killing of Frank Kennedy and crippled Tommy Welburn, and how Ashley was wounded in carrying Frank's body away. Some of the feeling of bitter hatred the women bore Scarlett for her share in the tragedy was mitigated by the knowledge that her husband was dead, and she knew it and could not admit it, and have the poor comfort of claiming his body. Until morning light disclosed the bodies and the authorities notified her, she must know nothing. Frank and Tommy, pistols in cold hands, lay stiffened among the dead weeds in a vacant lot. And the Yankees would say they killed each other in a common drunken brawl over a girl in Belle's house. Sympathy ran high for Fanny, Tommy's wife, who had just had a baby. But no one could slip through the darkness to see her and comfort her, because a squad of Yankees surrounded the house waiting for Tommy to return. And there was another squad about Aunt Pitty's house, waiting for Frank. Before dawn, the news had trickled about that the military inquiry would take place that day. The townspeople, heavy-eyed from sleeplessness and anxious waiting, knew that the safety of some of their most prominent citizens rested on three things: the ability of Ashley Wilkes to stand on his feet and appear before the military board, as though he suffered nothing more serious than a morning after headache. The word of Belle Watling that these men had been in her house all evening, and the word of Rhett Butler that he had been with them. The town writhed at these last two. Belle Watling. To owe their men's lives to her, it was intolerable. Women who had ostentatiously crossed the street when they saw Belle coming wondered if she remembered and trembled for fear she did. The men felt less humiliation at taking their lives from Belle than the women did, for many of them thought her a good sort. But they were stung that they must owe lives and freedom to Rhett Butler, a speculator and a scalawag. Belle and Rhett, the town's best-known fancy woman and the town's most hated man. And they must be under obligation to them. Another thought that stung them to impotent wrath was the knowledge that the Yankees and carpetbaggers would laugh. Oh, how they would laugh! 12 of the town's most prominent citizens revealed as habitual frequenters of Belle Watling's sporting house. 2 of them killed in a fight over a cheap little girl. Others ejected from the place as too drunk to be tolerated even by Belle, and some under arrest, refusing to admit they were there when everyone knew where they were. Atlanta was right in fearing that the Yankees would laugh. They had squirmed too long beneath Southern coldness and contempt, and now they exploded with hilarity. Officers woke comrades and retailed the news. Husbands roused wives at dawn and told them as much as could be decently told to women. And the women, dressing hastily, knocked on their neighbors' doors and spread the story. The Yankee ladies were charmed with it all and laughed until tears ran down their faces. This was Southern chivalry and gallantry for you. Maybe those women who carried their heads so high and snubbed all attempts at friendliness wouldn't be so uppity now that everyone knew where their husbands spent their time when they were supposed to be at political meetings. Political meetings! Well, that was funny. But even as they laughed, they expressed regret for Scarlett and her tragedy. After all, Scarlett was a lady, and one of the few ladies in Atlanta who were nice to Yankees. She had already won their sympathy by the fact that she had to work because her husband couldn't or wouldn't support her properly. Even though her husband was a sorry one, it was dreadful that the poor thing should discover he had been untrue to her. And it was doubly dreadful that his death should occur simultaneously with the discovery of his infidelity. After all, a poor husband was better than no husband at all, and the Yankee ladies decided they'd be extra nice to Scarlett. But the others, Mrs. Meade, Mrs. Merriweather, Mrs. Elsing, Tommy Wilburn's widow, and most of all, Mrs. Ashley Wilkes, they'd laugh in their faces every time they saw them. That would teach them a little courtesy. Much of the whispering that went on in the dark rooms on the north side of town that night was on this same subject. Atlanta ladies vehemently told their husbands that they did not care a rap what the Yankees thought. But inwardly, they felt that running an Indian gauntlet would be infinitely preferable to suffering the ordeal of Yankee grins and not being able to tell the truth about their husbands. Dr. Meade, beside himself with outraged dignity at the position into which Rhett had jockeyed him and the others, told Mrs. Meade that, but for the fact it would implicate the others, he would rather confess and be hanged than say he had been at Belle's house. "It is an insult to you, Mrs. Meade," he fumed. "But everyone will know you weren't there for...
"The Yankees won't know. They'll have to believe it if we save our necks, and they'll laugh. The very thought that anyone will believe it and laugh infuriates me. And it insults you because, my dear, I have always been faithful to you."
"I know that." And in the darkness Mrs. Meade smiled and slipped a thin hand into the doctor's. "But I'd rather it were really true than have one hair of your head in danger."
"Mrs. Meade, do you know what you're saying?" cried the doctor, aghast at the unexpected realism of his wife.
"Yes, I know. I've lost Darcy and I've lost Phil, and you are all I have, and rather than lose you, I'd have you take up your permanent abode at that place.
You are distrait. You cannot know what you're saying.
You old fool, said Mrs. Meade tenderly, and laid her head against his sleeve.
Dr. Meade fumed into silence and stroked her cheek, and then exploded again. And to be under obligation to that butler man, hanging would be easy compared with that. No, not even if I owe him my life can I be polite to him. His insolence is monumental, and his shamelessness about his profiteering makes me boil. To owe my life to a man who never went in the army.
Melly said he enlisted after Atlanta fell.
It's a lie. Miss Melly will believe any plausible scoundrel. And what I can't understand is why he's doing all this, going to all this trouble. I hate to say it, but... Well, there's always been talk about him and Mrs. Kennedy. I've seen them coming in from rides together too often this last year. He must have done it because of her.
If it was because of Scarlett, he wouldn't have lifted his hand. He'd have been glad to see Frank Kennedy hanged. I think it's because of Melly.
Mrs. Meade, you can't be insinuating that there's ever been anything between those two.
Oh, don't be silly. But she's always been unaccountably fond of him ever since he tried to get Ashley exchanged during the war. And I must say this for him. He never smiles in that nasty, nice way when he's with her. He's just as pleasant and thoughtful as can be. Really, a different man. You can tell by the way he acts with Melly that he could be decent if he wanted to. Now, my idea of why he's doing all this is... She paused. Doctor, you won't like my idea.
I don't like anything about this whole affair.
Well, I think he did it partly for Melly's sake, but mostly because he thought it would be a huge joke on us all. We've hated him so much and showed it so plainly, and now he's got us in a fix where... All of you have your choice of saying you were at that Watling woman's house and shaming yourself and wives before the Yankees, or telling the truth and getting hanged. And he knows we'll all be under obligation to him and his mistress, and that we'd almost rather be hanged than be obliged to them. Oh, I'll wager he's enjoying it. The doctor groaned. He did look amused when he took us upstairs in that place.
Doctor, Mrs. Meade hesitated. What did it look like?
What are you saying, Mrs. Meade?
Her house, what did it look like? Are there cut glass chandeliers, and red plush curtains, and dozens of full-length gilt mirrors? And were the girls... Were they unclothed?
Good God! Cried the doctor, thunderstruck, for it had never occurred to him... that the curiosity of a chaste woman concerning her unchaste sisters was so devouring.
How can you ask such immodest questions? You are not yourself. I will mix you a sedative.
I don't want a sedative. I want to know. Oh, dear. This is my only chance to know what a bad house looks like, and now you're mean enough not to tell me.
I noticed nothing. I assure you I was too embarrassed at finding myself in such a place to take note of my surroundings.
Said the doctor formally, more upset at this unsuspected revelation of his wife's character than he had been by all the previous events of the evening.
If you will excuse me now, I will try to get some sleep.
Well, go to sleep then, she answered, disappointment in her tones. Then, as the doctor leaned over to remove his boots, her voice spoke from the darkness with renewed cheerfulness.
I imagine Dolly has gotten it all out of old man Merriweather, and she can tell me about it.
Good heavens, Mrs. Meade! Do you mean to tell me that nice women talk about such things among them?
Oh, go to bed, said Mrs. Meade. It sleeted the next day, but as the wintry twilight drew on, the icy particles stopped falling and a cold wind blew. Wrapped in her cloak, Melanie went bewilderedly down her front walk, behind a strange Negro coachman who had summoned her mysteriously to a closed carriage waiting in front of the house. As she came up to the carriage, the door was opened, and she saw a woman in the dim interior. Leaning closer, peering inside, Melanie questioned, "Who is it?"
Won't you come in the house? It's so cold.
Please come in here and sit with me a minute, Miss Wilkes.
Came the faintly familiar voice, an embarrassed voice from the depths of the carriage.
Oh, you're Mrs. Watling, cried Melanie. I did so want to see you. You must come in the house.
I can't do that, Miss Wilkes.
Belle Watling's voice sounded scandalized. You come in here and sit a minute with me. Melanie entered the carriage, and the coachman closed the door behind her. She sat down beside Belle and reached for her hand.
How can I ever thank you enough for what you did today? How can any of us thank you enough?
Miss Wilkes, you hadn't ought to have sent me that note this morning. Not that I wasn't proud to have a note from you, but the Yankees might have got it. And as for saying you was going to call on me to thank me, why, Miss Wilkes, you must have lost your mind. The very idea. I come up here as soon as 'twas dark to tell you you mustn't think of any such thing. Why, it wouldn't be fitting at all.
It wouldn't be fitting for me to call and thank a kind woman who saved my husband's life.
Oh, shucks, Miss Wilkes. You know what I mean.
Melanie was silent for a moment, embarrassed by the implication. Somehow this handsome, sedately dressed woman sitting in the darkness of the carriage didn't look and talk as she imagined a bad woman, the madam of a house, should look and talk. She sounded like, well, a little common and countrified, but nice and warm-hearted.
"You were wonderful before the provost marshal today, Mrs. Watling. You and the other, the young lady certainly saved our men's lives."
"Mr. Wilkes was the wonderful one. I don't know how he even stood up and told his story, much less look as cool as he done. He was sure bleeding like a pig when I seen him last night. Is he going to be all right, Miss Wilkes?"
"Yes, thank you. The doctor says it's just a flesh wound, though he did lose a tremendous lot of blood. This morning he was, well, he was pretty well laced with brandy, or he'd never have had the strength to go through with it all so well. But it was you, Mrs. Watling, who saved them. When you got mad and talked about the broken mirrors, you sounded so convincing."
"Thank you, ma'am, but I thought Captain Butler done mighty fine, too,"
said Belle, shy pride in her voice. "Oh, he was wonderful," cried Melanie warmly. "The Yankees couldn't help but believe his testimony. He was so smart about the whole affair. I can never thank him enough. Or you either. How good and kind you are."
"Thank you kindly, Miss Wilkes. It was a pleasure to do it. I hope it ain't going to embarrass you none, me saying Mr. Wilkes come regular to my place. He never, you know..."
"Yes, I know. No, it doesn't embarrass me at all. I'm just so grateful to you."
"I'll bet the other ladies aren't grateful to me," said Belle with sudden venom. "And I'll bet they ain't grateful to Captain Butler, neither. I'll bet they'll hate him just this much more. I'll bet you'll be the only lady who even says thanks to me. I'll bet they won't even look me in the eye when they see me on the street. But I don't care. I wouldn't have minded if all their husbands got hung, but I did mind about Mr. Wilkes. You see, I ain't forgot how nice you was to me during the war, about the money for the hospital. There ain't never been a lady in this town nice to me like you was, and I don't forget a kindness. And I thought about you being left a widder with a little boy if Mr. Wilkes got hung, and he's a nice little boy, your boy is, Miss Wilkes. I got a boy myself, and so I..."
"Oh, you have? Does he live,
Oh, no. He ain't here in Atlanta. He ain't never been here. He's off at school. I ain't seen him since he was little. Well, anyway, when Captain Butler wanted me to lie for those men, I wanted to know who the men was, and when I heard Mr. Wilkes was one, I never hesitated. I said to my girls, I said, I'll whale the living daylights out of you all if you don't make a special point of saying you was with Mr. Wilkes all evening.
Oh, said Melanie, still more embarrassed by Belle's offhand reference to her girls. Oh, that was, kind of you, and of them, too.
No more than you deserve, said Belle warmly. But I wouldn't have did it for just anybody. If it had been that Miss Kennedy's husband by himself, I wouldn't have lifted a finger, no matter what Captain Butler said.
Why?
Well, Miss Wilkes, people in my business knows a heap of things. It'd surprise and shock a heap of fine ladies if they had any notion how much we knows about them. And she ain't no good, Miss Wilkes. She killed her husband and that nice Wilburn boy, same as if she shot them. She caused it all, prancing about Atlanta by herself, enticing niggers and trash. Why, not one of my girls.
You must not say unkind things about my sister-in-law. Melanie stiffened coldly. Belle put an eager, placating hand on Melanie's arm and then hastily withdrew it.
Don't freeze me, please, Miss Wilkes. I couldn't stand it after you'd been so kind and sweet to me. I forgot how you liked her, and I'm sorry for what I said. I'm sorry about poor Mr. Kennedy's being dead, too. He was a nice man. I used to buy some of the stuff for my house from him, and he always treated me pleasant. But Miss Kennedy, well, she just ain't in the same class with you, Miss Wilkes. She's a mighty cold woman, and I can't help it if I think so. When are they going to bury Mr. Kennedy?
Tomorrow morning. And you are wrong about Mrs. Kennedy. Why, this very minute she's prostrated with grief.
Maybe so, said Belle with evident disbelief. Well, I gotta be going. I'm afraid somebody might recognize this carriage if I stayed here longer, and that wouldn't do you no good. And Miss Wilkes, if you ever see me on the street, you don't have to speak to me. I'll understand.
I shall be proud to speak to you. Proud to be under obligation to you. I hope we meet again.
No, said Belle. That wouldn't be fitting.
Good night. Chapter 47. Scarlett sat in her bedroom, picking at the supper tray Mammy had brought her, listening to the wind hurling itself out of the night. The house was frighteningly still, quieter even than when Frank had lain in the parlor just a few hours before. Then there had been tiptoeing feet and hushed voices, muffled knocks on the front door, neighbors rustling in to whisper sympathy and occasional sobs from Frank's sister, who had come up from Jonesboro for the funeral. But now, the house was cloaked in silence. Although her door was open, she could hear no sounds from below stairs. Wade and the baby had been at Melanie's since Frank's body was brought home, and she missed the sound of the boy's feet and Ella's gurgling. There was a truce in the kitchen, and no sound of quarreling from Peter, Mammy, and Cookie floated up to her. Even Aunt Pitty, downstairs in the library, was not rocking her creaking chair in deference to Scarlet's sorrow. No one intruded upon her, believing that she wished to be left alone with her grief. But to be left alone was the last thing Scarlet desired. Had it only been grief that companioned her, she could have borne it as she had borne other griefs. But added to her stunned sense of loss at Frank's death were fear and remorse and the torment of a suddenly awakened conscience. For the first time in her life, she was regretting things she had done. Regretting them with a sweeping superstitious fear that made her cast sidelong glances at the bed upon which she had lain with Frank. She had killed Frank. She had killed him just as surely as if it had been her finger that pulled the trigger. He had begged her not to go about alone, but she hadn't listened to him. And now he was dead because of her obstinacy. God would punish her for that. But there lay upon her conscience another matter
that was heavier and more frightening even than causing his death, a matter which had never troubled her until she looked upon his coffined face. There had been something helpless and pathetic in that still face which had accused her. God would punish her for marrying him when he really loved Sue Ellen. She would have to cower at the seat of judgment and answer for that lie she told him coming back from the Yankee camp in his buggy. Useless for her to argue now that the end justified the means, that she was driven into trapping him, that the fate of too many people hung on her for her to consider either his or Sue Ellen's rights and happiness. The truth stood out boldly, and she cowered away from it. She had married him coldly, and used him coldly. And she had made him unhappy during the last 6 months, when she could have made him very happy. God would punish her for not being nicer to him. Punish her for all her bullyings and proddings and storms of temper and cutting remarks, for alienating his friends and shaming him by operating the mills and building the saloon and leasing convicts. She had made him very unhappy, and she knew it. But he had borne it all like a gentleman. The only thing she had ever done that gave him any real happiness was to present him with Ella. And she knew if she could have kept from having Ella, Ella would never have been born. She shivered, frightened, wishing Frank were alive so she could be nice to him. So very nice to him to make up for it all. Oh, if only God didn't seem so furious and vengeful. Oh, if only the minutes didn't go by so slowly and the house were not so still. If only she were not so alone. If only Melanie were here with her. Melanie could calm her fears. But Melanie was at home nursing Ashley. For a moment Scarlett thought of summoning Pitypat to stand between her and her conscience, but she hesitated. Pity would probably make matters worse, for she honestly mourned Frank. He had been more her contemporary than Scarlett's, and she had been devoted to him. He had filled to perfection Pity's need for a man in the house, for he brought her little presents and harmless gossip, jokes and stories, read the paper to her at night and explained topics of the day to her while she mended his socks. She had fussed over him and planned special dishes for him and coddled him during his innumerable colds. Now she missed him acutely, and repeated over and over as she dabbed at her red, swollen eyes, "If only he hadn't gone out with the Klan!" If there were only someone who could comfort her, quiet her fears, explain to her just what were these confused fears which made her heart sink with such cold sickness. If only Ashley... But she shrank from the thought. She had almost killed Ashley, just as she had killed Frank. And if Ashley ever knew the real truth about how she lied to Frank to get him, knew how mean she had been to Frank, he could never love her any more. Ashley was so honorable, so truthful, so kind, and he saw so straightly, so clearly. If he knew the whole truth, he would understand. Oh, yes, he would understand only too well. But he would never love her any more. So he must never know the truth, because he must keep on loving her. How could she live if that secret source of her strength, his love, were taken from her? But what a relief it would be to put her head on his shoulder and cry and unburden her guilty heart. The still house, with a sense of death heavy upon it, pressed about her loneliness, until she felt she couldn't bear it unaided any longer. She arose cautiously, pushed her door half-closed, and then dug about in the bottom bureau drawer beneath her underwear. She produced Aunt Pitty's swoon bottle of brandy, which she had hidden there, and held it up to the lamp. It was nearly half-empty. Surely she hadn't drunk that much since last night. She poured a generous amount into her water glass and gulped it down. She would have to put the bottle back in the cellarette before morning, filled to the top with water.
Mammy had hunted for it just before the funeral when the pallbearers wanted a drink. And already the air in the kitchen was electric with suspicion between Mammy, Cookie, and Peter. The brandy burned with fiery pleasantness. There was nothing like it when you needed